The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
If you were looking for a 30-foot tow chain and you found three separate pieces of links, the front one, the back one, and one out of the middle, about 60 yards apart, would you say you'd found the whole chain? Would you hook up the first one to the back of your car and the back one to the tractor you wanted to tow and take off somewhere? I very much doubt it, and yet that's the way evolutionists have to face the problem of how did birds evolve from crocodiles, and how did you and I come to be here out of green slime or brown scum or polka-dotted air bubbles in the sea or amoebic dysentery or whatever it is the way they tell it? You know, evolutionists have a real headache these days because the real science fiction writers have been found in some of the slick paper books and textbooks, the very thick ones with good plates and illustrations that are found in college classrooms of students who may be studying for a degree so they can go join an oil company and maybe get into exploration. They have to know stratigraphy. They have to know a little bit about geology and maybe about some of the fossil life they expect to find. Reminds me of this fellow that was going down in the middle of Main Street about 2 a.m. and the policeman arrested him because he was dragging his chain. He had a chain over his shoulder and he was dragging it down the middle of the road. And the cop said, "Hey, fella, what are you doing dragging that chain down the middle of the road?" He says, "Officer, did you ever try to push one?" Well, the guy had a point there, but evolution is not just looking for the missing link. They're looking for the whole chain. What they have is one or two or three links that they have said fit together, which actually don't. Well, I'll show you what their problem is. And also, that evolution is in reality a new religion, an assertion of dogma without any basis whatsoever in fact. Here's a quotation from Science, December 30th, back in 1960. So it's an old one, but one past president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science wrote this in support of man's evolutionary origin. So when you consider the broad spectrum of the subject matter covered, it's not all that old. He says, and I relate his words to you, "Come now, if you will, on a speculative excursion into prehistory. Assume the era in which the species sapiens emerged from the genus Homo. Hasten across the millenniums, for which the present information depends for the most part on conjecture and interpretation, to the era of the first inscribed records from which some facts may be gleaned." Now that's a giant leap, isn't it? Hasten across millennia of time into the first record, that means some of the Precambrian or the Cambrian strata, in which you might find some little trilobites from which some facts may be gleaned. Another book on the ideas of biology. An evolutionist named J.T. Bonner said the following: "The cell is really such an astoundingly clever unit that when we think of it from the point of view of evolution, it seems easier to imagine a single cell evolving into complex animals and plants than it does to imagine a group of chemical substances evolving into a cell. The study of early evolution really amounts to educated guesswork." Now, when a person who is educated guesses, is he any more likely to discover the answer than a person who is not educated and maybe is endowed with a little bit of common sense instead? Another book states the possibility, and I'm quoting now, of the appropriate elements, energy, and suitable environment coming together by chance seems remote indeed. But in tremendously longer periods of time, the impossible becomes inevitable. Now, here's a part of the problem they have, and I think this book from a noted evolutionist, Lauren Isley, who wrote the book called The Immense Journey, and I think that's a very apt title. He said, and I quote, "One does occasionally observe a tendency for the beginning zoological textbook to take the unwary reader by a hop, skip, and a jump from the little steaming pond or the beneficent chemical crucible of the sea into the lower world of life with such sureness and rapidity that it is easy to assume that there is no mystery about this matter at all, or if there is one, that it's a very little one." This attitude, he said, was sharply criticized by a distinguished British biologist who was named Woodger, who remarked some years ago, "Unstable organic compounds," he was talking here about amoeba like this, "and chlorophyll corpuscles do not persist or come into existence in nature on their own account at the present day. And consequently, it is necessary to postulate." Now, postulate means we guess, we think, maybe, "that conditions were once such as this did happen, although, and in spite of the fact that our knowledge of nature does not give us any warrant for making such a supposition. Now, what if this was a trial in a courtroom, and you had a whole group of people there, and you're on trial, you know, and they're absolutely insisting that you're guilty of the most monstrous crime. And so the judge says, all right, now let's get down to cases, and let's ask this person here who is witnessing against the defendant for the precise, concise statement that he wishes to make about the defendant's alleged guilt. So the guy says, now, although I didn't see it happen, and although all the character references might indicate that it didn't happen, and even though actually it may appear to everybody in the courtroom to be impossible that this man could have committed such a crime, and my present knowledge makes it appear to be absolutely impossible, I do believe, however, there is sufficient reason to warrant a supposition that it might have occurred so. You're not going to get a conviction out of that kind of evidence in the courtrooms, thank God. I mean, if you and I are ever on trial, we sure don't want it to work that way, now do we? But here's an evolutionist, and they are, you know, a lot of them are pretty square fellows. They admit that they don't have too many of the links to put together much of a chain. Matter of fact, they're still looking for the whole chain, let alone any missing links. But to go on with this, because I have said time and again that they claim it is simple dogmatism. And let me quote the rest of it. He says, in spite of the fact that our knowledge of nature does not give us any warrant for making such a supposition, it is simple dogmatism, asserting that what you want to believe did, in fact, happen. Well, there it is. I'm not attacking anybody. I hope you understand this. Evolutionists freely admit they believe in dogmatism. It's just that I want you, the general public, to know that they do, because I don't think that type of quotation has very widespread or sensational publication before the general public. I think when a newspaper science writer who was obviously interested in headlines, all newspaper writers are, I don't care what desk they work at, if they can get a story where it gets on front page, you know what Christ said about the scribes? He was a little irked about his press, just like Richard Nixon used to be. But at any rate, they're trying to sensationalize something. So time and time again, Mrs. Housewife hears this, well, science has created life in a test tube, or origins of first life found. Or they hear about amino acids, or they hear about chlorophyll, or about methane and ammonia, or about men running around grunting, dragging women by the hair in a cave 600,000 years ago. And vaguely somehow, out of childhood Bible stories and memory verses and Sunday school and the stories about Adam and Eve, they come to have a kind of a watered down, a little bit of a conflict in their minds. So in people's daily lives, they want oftentimes to call upon a power greater than they are. Many people say they believe in God, but really there's a suspicion that maybe it's about as empty a faith as evolution after all, and that maybe there isn't really anybody up there, but just in case. Or maybe they say psychologically a human being has the need to believe in something outside himself, something greater than himself. Evolutionists disagree. They apparently say you have the need, because they admit it's dogmatism, to believe in something simpler than yourself. You have the need to believe in amoeba. You have the need to believe that randomness and happenstance and mere accident became absolute harmony and intricate interdependability. You don't believe that actually, but that's what they ask you to believe. Well, what is there really simple about first life? It boils down to this. In this fourth proof that I'm now talking about, we proved the first three in these seven proofs that God does exist. The first was that giant, immutable, incontrovertible law that acts upon us and that regulates the entirety of the vastness of this complex universe, our whole solar system, and this earth and all life forms upon it, that law demands a lawgiver. The second was, we know that life comes only from life. We know that matter does exist. And life, remember, requires a life giver. That's proof number two. We know that matter does exist and that there has been no past eternity of matter. We have proved this and demonstrated it in past programs. It's an absolute fact. It's a fact that is admitted to by science. So far, science admits to all of these things. Law cannot come into existence by and of itself. Science has never proved this and doesn't try. Life cannot come into existence by itself. Science has never proved this and does not really try. Oh, they claim that they're able to create some of the constituents that make up portions of cellular life. But not for one instant does science say it has created life, per se. It's Some people don't even know what life is. Even the Supreme Court doesn't know exactly what it is or when it stops. They've gotten to the point now, I think, where they said that you're dead when your brain dies. Well, you know, the heart transplant thing you might have seen in Mad Magazine one time. It's kind of sick. I think Life Magazine ran a thing on this one day. The fellow who hit his head against the tree stump when his bicycle fell over, and they rushed up and put a stethoscope on him. They found the heart was alive, but the brain was dead. And so they transplanted it right quickly. And it was a kind of a grisly story. But at any rate, we get down to the point that here in our modern space age, even the Supreme Court of the United States of America has had to define what constitutes death. So science doesn't really even define what life is. But life, we know, comes only from pre-existing life. Now, the creation demands a creator, and I'll come right back and tell you what is proof number four.
From the dawn of history, man has sought to understand the forces that act around him. Ancient philosophers visualized every different power as a separate god. In this modern age of laser beams and space technology, we understand how to use these forces, but we still don't know how they came into being. What should we be able to learn from the existence of matter, energy, force, and inertia? Does God exist? Is a free booklet that dares to look at our world, God, and science objectively. Does God exist? Uses the tools of modern technology to prove how the laws and forces acting upon us every day clearly demonstrate the existence of God. From the dawn of history, man has sought to understand. Now you can know. Request, does God exist? Dial this toll-free number. 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
I said last time, if the young bride says she's pregnant, then the husband knows the baby is going to be human. He knows that. All he's got are two choices. He says, I hope it's either a boy or a girl. And certainly with the abnormalities today, and what with the thalidomide thing that came along, it's kind of a new hope, let's say, all over again. I know that every father begins to count all the fingers and the toes, and he's very blessed and very happy when he finds that it's a normal child. So I don't say that just entirely in jest, but we do know that kind produces after kind. That's in the space age. I don't care whether you're talking about a science fiction capsule headed across the universe at twice or three times the speed of light. The science fictionists really are evolutionists who claim that these sudden leaps could have occurred, but we still find that today, in the modern space age, humans produce humans, and cows, cows, and horses, horses, and pigs, pigs, and chickens, chickens, and so on. But, you know, evolutionists say that that was not always necessarily so. So if we are the result of a timeless, ageless process whereby the simple became complex, whereby the fittest did survive, and sometimes when you look at cantankerous man, you really wonder, was he the most fit, if that's the story, the way it goes. What we see today with our eyes, and what science tells us with all of its tools today, is that kind reproduces after its own kind. Well, you know, that's pretty biblical, because right back in the first chapter of the book of Genesis, the creation chapter, it says in verse 21, God created great whales, and every living creature that moves, which the waters brought forth abundantly, after their kind. And every winged fowl, after his kind. And God saw that it was good. It's still good. It's still accurate. It's still up to date. And it's very scientific. Now, a kind, such as humankind, is capable of almost limitless variety within a kind. And it's capable even of mutations. But science has demonstrated, and I'll get to the thing of mutations a little bit later on in this series, science has demonstrated that about 99% of all mutants are harmful, and only about 1% are not so harmful. Mutations do not prove a leap from one kind to another kind at all, but they do prove a tendency or a propensity for the degeneration of a species through wrong breeding. Let me get right down to the very basis of the whole thing, the fossil record. Let's get down to bedrock, so to speak. The fossil record is where evolutionists, and especially evolutionary biologists and geneticists and comparative embryologists or comparative anatomists and so on, these various specialized fields, really seem to make a lot of points from studying the fossil record. Well, let's propose a weird experiment. Let's say you got all kinds of dead bodies, a whole carload full. Now, out here, you got a flood roaring by. You want roiled, completely muddy waters filled with all kinds of soluble materials, clays and sands and silts and muds and whatnot. Because remember, as we talk about this iffy kind of an experiment, that the broad majority of all the rocks under our feet are sedimentary. That is, they were water deposited. Now, let's say we've got an entire U.S.-sized railroad car full of bodies. We've got a, perish the thought, a man. We have an elephant. We've got several different kinds of horses all the way down to Shetlands. We've got dogs and chickens and pigs and cattle. And we've got birds. And then we've got a whole lot of lesser animals, smaller ones, like maybe a mandrill. And we've got some crustaceans. We've got some clams. We've got a couple of maybe armadillos. And then we have even some tiny little life, like maybe the tiny mollusks and even some crabs and so on. They're all in this great big freight car. Okay, we come to the end of a cliff, and this roaring, turgid, muddy mass is going by with floating tree trunks, and we dump all this business in. Now, gradually, this flood water subsides, and all of these bodies have been carried along by the current. But that little clam heads almost straight down. Like a rock, this thing sinks. It goes right to the bottom. Now, some of these other creatures begin to fill with water, and they gradually sink. Some of the other warm-blooded mammals begin to bloat, and they float along on the top, like the man or even the elephant. And they're carried different distances and deposited in different places and at different depths, depending upon the sectional density of the body, the amount of air that it may carry, the weight, the strength of the current. Now, anybody that's hosed off his own driveway knows that you move the big rocks of the big stream and out along the sides of the tiny silts and so on. You can recreate it, a kind of an erosion pattern in your own yard with a hose. Water sorts things. Floods do this. In the horrible catastrophe at Rapid City, many of those bodies were never found because they were washed downstream of the tendency of a human body to float, either at a certain level in the stream below, beneath the surface, because of certain air that is still captured in a body. A grisly thought, but that's what happened. A lot of them went downstream and maybe even on into the Mississippi River. Who knows? But that is what would happen. Scientifically, I mean it. If you dumped a whole carload of bodies of all different types, now you would find them then when the storm subsides and all these silts and muds and clays and sands have begun to harden and form rock. You would find all of these bodies in different places. The elephant and the man would be up near the surface somewhere. And the clam and the crustaceans and all the heavier, denser little bodies that might look very primitive, such as an armadillo or a trilobite, would be down near the bottom. The fossil record is pointed out by evolutionists as being the real proof of evolution. But you know how they date strata? And you know how fossils are dated? Fossils are dated according to the age of the stratum in which they are found, and the strata are dated according to the age of the fossils which are reposing in them. In just a moment, I'll come back and tell you a little bit about the fascinating subject of stratigraphy and ask you the question, when you find your bed made up in the morning after you're in there shaving, your wife's been real busy, and the bedspread is on, did she put the sheet on the bed before the bedspread, or is she a magician?
Wouldn't it be nice to buy just one gift at the
That's
whole
time? That's the time many doctors recommend.
Fund if you send them in.
For further information on buying and selling gold, consult any bank.
And it's absolutely free.
The human mind is constantly bombarded with ideas. Some good, some bad.
Hearings were scheduled to conclude today.
The opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent
the law requires a substantial interest penalty.
All you gotta do is buy two.
You're responsible for making the right choices.
And at reasonable prices.
Void where prohibited by law.
No purchase necessary.
Plain Truth helps you unjangle the conflict of ideas in our over-communicated world. This monthly publication offers straightforward insight and understanding. Proving which ideas in this world are valuable and which are not is your responsibility. Plain Truth can help. Request your subscription today. There's no cost or obligation. Plain Truth. Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
You know, unless your wife has 16 hands and she's awful fast, the chances are when you find the bed made up with the bedspread on top, that's about the way she made it up. She put the sheet on there first, and then the cover, and then the bedspread. And that's the way the rocks were laid down under our feet. Science admits this. But the point is, you may not realize there are many so-called exceptions to this rule. It should be a rule everywhere. Now, I can show you some of the actual exceptions, because you can go out and take a drive if you live in a mountainous area. People in Los Angeles, if they were driving to Bakersfield, let's say, can drive up through what was called a grapevine, I guess it still is, and they're driving right along the San Andreas Fault, and they can see on both sides of them strata which are kind of lying on their sides, and where they've been ruptured by the faulting action of the crust of the earth. There are such things as isoclines, that's one big fold. Let's say that a faulting action just causes a kind of an overthrust to begin to develop. It folds over, just like you're maybe folding the egg white into the pancake batter, except that we're dealing here with softened rock, the sedimentary deposits like claystones and sandstones and whatnot. And when it does then harden in that form, surely you're going to find what was a top layer has had superposed upon it the same top layer, and then underneath layers, and come back to the top layer again. So you're going to find younger, and then older, older, younger, 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 and so on top. So there is such a thing as an isocline. There are synclines and geosynclines. But these don't account for all of the interbedding, the crossbedding, the non-uniformity, and some of the inexplicable problems that confront stratigraphers in the subject of evolution, as I intend to thoroughly demonstrate so you'll get the point. It boils down to this basic question: catastrophism versus uniformitarianism. Now, those sound like big words, but let's simplify them. Were the rocks that form our mountains, the rocks in which the fossil life is found, the coal beds, the buried ferns, and all of the animal life that makes up the oil and the coal deposits that make our fuel even for modern-day space-age jets, were all of these things laid down under present conditions as we see them today, uniformly, year in and year out, just about the same, with just the once in a while small flood years or upset or dry cycles that you can determine by looking at the rings of a tree, did everything as it's going today? The Mississippi River is flowing at a certain rate. It's depositing silt down there in the delta past New Orleans at a certain rate. What do? Do you measure the rate of the positive silts today, of that beautiful farmland that goes roaring by all the time, you know, too thin to plow and too thick to drink, as they say. Now it's called the colon of Mid-America, unfortunately, because it's draining all of these thousands of chemicals and toxic poisons and everything that's leaching out of the streams and off the land and from all the factories along the way, but that's another subject. But can you measure these deposits and then wade back through history and say, therefore, the Mississippi River is X number of thousands of years of age? To a point, you can. And did you know that most major rivers are about 4,000 years of age, using that as a basis for your figuring? If you could look at the bed of the ancient Mississippi River, it would be about yay wide, where the bed of the present Mississippi River would be just a little tiny dot in the middle of that. Because at one original time, when the mid-continent of America was drained, the Mississippi River was a vast river, many, many times bigger than it is presently. The western part of the United States used to be absolutely a solid, porous lake almost, and all these dry beds and dry lakes in California are exemplary of that fact. And take a look sometime at the ancient Lake Bonneville. That is the obvious boundary of what was a vast lake, of which Salt Lake, Great Salt Lake, is just a little puddle in which all of these mineral salts have been concentrated after all these thousands of years. There was a time, in short, when the rocks beneath our feet were all soft, when most of them were deposited by water, then the pressure, disturbances in the crust, the movement of continents, the principle of isostasy, which has to do basically with a mountain above, is going to be just about proportionate to the amount of the mantle of the crust underneath, and where it's thinner, it's going to be thinner underneath, and so on. But some of these principles that work upon the crust of the earth that cause the earth movements, the faultings, and therefore the earthquakes, brought about metamorphic changes. Dynamic change is a result of heat and pressure and weight and the crushing and the grating action of rocks. It produces metamorphosed stone, such as our granites and some of these others. All right, then third and the least common rock that we know of is igneous, which is fire-formed, or these are basaltic or magma intrusions that come out either in the form of the more classic cinder cones are just slag or magma flows that we see all around the West and even the Hawaiian Islands and whole island chains that are actually fire-formed in origin. So get it down to the basic issues, and I'll come back and talk about that later. It's simply this. Do you see, with your eyes, catastrophe having formed the rocks and deposited the fossils, or do you see gradual, timeless, ageless uniformity having deposited them? Remember the song back in World War II, "There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover"? Well, the white cliffs of Dover are a unique deposit. Fantastic tens of millions of little bodies of crustaceans and of sea life, such as clams and all kinds of shells, that make those chalk cliffs. This material becomes chalk-like as it decomposes. Did that happen gradually? Do you know of any place at all where you can go, any beach, any seashore, any coast, where any tidal waves of sufficient size, or tsunamis more appropriately, are coming in with such regularity that they are depositing ton after ton after ton of shells, one on top of the other, without sufficiently grinding them all to bits, that instead of becoming a clay or a silt or a tiny white sand, those bodies are still discernible there? What about some of the fantastic quarries over in Turkey or in Italy, where some of the marbles are obtained that make up your coffee table, or maybe even some of the beautiful facades and decorative pieces for big buildings and inside the bank where you trade? You can actually see in some of these marbles the outline of fossil life. You'll see clams and all kinds of fossil shellfish that were imprisoned that became these marbles. Nowhere on the face of the earth is this happening today in such a catastrophic form. But somewhere, somehow, long ago, there were mass burials of life. There really were. Do you know that as recently as 1929, and for all I know, there's still a certain amount of it today, there were commercial industries in Siberia that were digging up and marketing the ivory from mammoth tusks that were buried suddenly. I understand in the Smithsonian Institute, there is a baby mammoth, and there are examples still refrigerated, dug out of this refrigerated tundra up in Siberia, of warm-blooded mammals, the elephant kind, but a slightly different and larger one than either the Indian or the African elephant of today, which were buried alive. So the question we need to ask is, does the fossil record prove that fossils were buried alive suddenly as the result of a giant catastrophe? In other words, catastrophism, which is merely the belief or the study that much of what you see in geology was laid down suddenly as a result of giant floods, unprecedented tidal waves and floods, which are not occurring, have never occurred in the living memory or the history of any tribal society. Catastrophism is something which can either be proved or disproved. What does the fossil record prove? When you find warm-blooded mammals instantly frozen in a kind of a tundra deep freeze, with green vegetation still in their mouths, then I'm here to tell you they died suddenly. You ought to write for this brochure a theory for the birds. And the reason that has a facetious title is exactly because we intended it to. This brochure, A Theory for the Birds, remember, is without cost. All you need to do to receive this brochure is to give us the call letters of your station. We'd like that. You would, please. The call letters of your radio station. I hope you'll write for it. We'll send it to you by return mail as soon as you dial that toll-free number, 800-423-4444. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.